It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out how many people in Wisconsin have signed up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act and why there's been concern about the age of the people signing up.
First, our next guest wants you to rethink the idea of failure. He says that from an early age, we're told to be cautious, think before acting, plan for the future, avoid failure at all costs.
But he says those ideas aren't all they're cracked up to be, and if you want to succeed in your career, in life, you have to fail, and you have to do it a lot. And some of the most successful people in the world spend less time planning and more time doing.
We're joined now by Ryan Babineau. He's a career counselor and co-author of the new book, Fail Fast, Fail Often, How Losing Can Help You Win. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you tell a story in your book about a ceramics class that really illustrates the point. Can you tell us that story, please?
Yes. The story was about a ceramics teacher at a community college that tried this experiment on his class. And he, at the beginning of the class, he divided the room into two groups. In one group of students, he asked them to, he told them that their grade for the class would be based on the production of pots. So they're making pots in the class. So how many they made over the course of the term. And he would just weigh the output of everything they produced. And if they made, I don't know what the number was, but let's say they made 20 pounds, that would be an A. And if they made 15 pounds, that would be a B, and so on. And the other group, he told them that their grade would be dependent on the best piece they made over the course of the entire class. So even if it was on the first week of class they made one very good piece, that would get them an A.
So what I would think hearing that is we'd end up with the quality group having a couple masterpieces, the quantity group having a big pile of crappy pottery. That's how did it really turn out, though?
Well, that was a surprise. How it actually turned out was that the group that was the quantity group, they just got right to work, and they just, you know, every day they were experimenting, having fun, making piece after piece, you know, making lots of mistakes. But in the process, they started to get better. I mean, they learned, you know, different ways to work with the clay. They improved their technique, and they actually ended up producing the best pieces in the class. On the other hand, the quality group, because they spent so much time kind of planning out, you know, the perfect piece they were going to do, and they really invested a lot of time on each piece they were working on, they really didn't work on that many over the length of the course, and because of that, they didn't improve. They didn't really get any better, and so their work was actually not as good as the quantity group.
So what do we learn from that? How do we apply that in our daily lives and our work lives?
Well, the lesson is that if you want to get good at something and learn, the best way to do it is do it badly as fast as you can. You know, it, just about anything you want to excel at, you need to do badly over a period of time before you learn the things that you need to learn to get better. But oftentimes the way that we approach things is we want to prepare, we want to really put a lot of effort in so we make sure we don't embarrass ourselves and make mistakes. But you know, if you look at successful people, they flip that. They look for opportunities where they can just get right out there. They can make mistakes. They can, you know, embarrass themselves. But they just learn at warp speed because they do that.
It sounds simple. It sounds kind of easy. But you used the word embarrassed there. And if I'm trying something new, especially something that other people will see the outcome of, I don't want it to be terrible. How do I overcome that fear of an embarrassing failure so I can start failing and learning?
Well, that's a big part of my whole approach. I work with people is changing their attitude towards failure. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, I work with people that are adults that have usually been successful already in their lives, and they're used to, you know, looking like experts and looking competent, and I encourage them to be willing to be a beginner at things. You know, just be a newbie. Be someone who's just out there to like try something, have fun. See, instead of seeing other people that as, you know, people that you want to impress, see them as teachers you can learn from. And it does take a shift in attitude, but it's really not that hard to do. It's just you just have to kind of change the way that you look at it, and once you can start seeing things from that perspective, it allows you to just embrace a lot more opportunities and have a lot more fun doing it.
We can learn a lot from kids, it seems like, right? They haven't learned to be afraid of failing like that, have they?
Yes. Yeah, it seems like, when we're born, we don't have this fear of failure. You know, kids are willing to just try anything. When they're contemplating, riding a bike or investigating something or, just trying something new, they don't say to themselves, oh, well, will I be good at it? Can I be better than Johnny? They just, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try it. And it's only as we, as we get older, we kind of learn to, we want to excel compared to others. And I don't know, I think that natural spontaneity is kind of beaten out of us in different ways. But yeah, absolutely. Kids, I know, like, my daughter's 8 years old, and definitely looking at how she approaches things really gives me an idea of the right way to go about life. Just, don't worry about the consequences or whether you're going to commit to something forever or whether you're going to perform well. Just if you're curious about it and want to try it, just go for it.
Speaking of kids, do I remember there was a story about chess in your book and a kid learning to approach chess?
Well, that kid was actually me.
That was you. Okay.
Yeah, that was my somewhat embarrassing story, but... When I decided to learn, before I kind of changed my perspective, I initially thought that, I guess I was really stuck in the idea that I didn't want to embarrass myself or perform poorly. And there was this local chess club, and I decided the best way to learn chess would be that I would practice on my own using this computer program until I got good enough, and then I would join the local club, and I would go in, and, I'd make this heroic entrance, and I would, perform really well. And, and then that would be the way to get into chess. And it turned out that the program that I practiced on wasn't that great a program. And when I went into the club, I was actually quickly humiliated by a better player. And I slunk away in shame. And, now I see that, gosh, that's the worst way to try to do it. My whole approach was to avoid losing games. And now if I did it, I would, try to lose 100 games. If I wanted to get into chess, I'm like, how quickly can I lose 100 games of chess? Because if that's my approach, I'm going to meet all sorts of people. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to be exposed. Someone probably would have told me that the chess program I was using, the computer program, was terrible. Yeah, it would have been such a better experience. So I've completely changed the way that I think about things like that now.
And speaking of having fun, that's another one of your lessons in the book, not a little tangential to the failure, but finding the fun and making sure you have it. Why is that important?
Yeah, fun is pretty crucial. One of the reasons that fun is really critical. So fear of failure, a lot of it is just being unwilling to take chances, being kind of stuck in a rut and, not willing to try something else. And one of the reasons that happens is when we kind of spend too much time gritting our teeth and kind of sticking with something that we don't really enjoy, and you get kind of beaten down and you lose your enthusiasm, and then you're just afraid of trying anything, and that's just leaves you just stuck in this rut and nothing ever changes. So it's really important to find a way every day to build in some time to do something that matters to you, whatever it is, something that's meaningful to you, that you enjoy. And if you do that, and by the way, there's a lot of research studies, and we talk about these in the book, there's research studies that show that if you have more enjoyment in your life, you're more creative, you're more productive, you're more open to new possibilities. I mean, it just changes the way that you look at your life. And, I mean, so some people kind of say, That's a kind of a side thing. I shouldn't really worry about having fun. But really, if you don't interject some enjoyment into your life, it is very hard to change and to be in the space where you're willing to try anything new.
We're talking with Ryan Babineau. He's co-author of Fail Fast, Fail Often. And we want to hear from you. Are we telling your story here? Did you decide to pursue a passion? Did you have failures in the process? What did you learn from your failures? And have you learned to take fun seriously and make time for it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Ryan Babineau. He says the key to success is failure. His new book is Fail Fast, Fail Often. We want to hear from you. In your career, in your personal life, how have you turned failures into successes? When you try something new, do you research carefully, plan it out, plot out everything you're going to do and then try it? Or do you dive in, learn from your failures? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Havik with us from Pewaukee. Havik, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great topic. I completely agree to the fact that failures will help you learn faster. But at the same time, I was wondering, how practical is it to fail in a corporate environment often and still have your job?
That's a great question, Havik. So if I'm in a job, I'm willing to fail all I want. Is my boss willing to have me fail all I want?
Well, bosses oftentimes are not so patient with people failing too often. But there is a way. I think the way to think about this is what you do before you fail. So if you look at successful companies, especially here in Silicon Valley, like, for example, Google is a great example. They have a way of approaching things like new projects or new services where they put the minimum investment into it. For example, they're famous for rolling out new services that they want to try. They roll them out as a beta or a testing version with, they just develop it to a minimal point, and then they put it out there and they see what happens. And then if it works out, great. They can improve it. If it's, a bust, I'm very sorry. Let me turn that.
That's all right.
I apologize for that. If it's a bust, they can move on to the next thing. So the way to think about this, I think, is to try to learn things in your corporate setting, to try projects with the minimal risk, the minimal investment. And if you find a way to, take that first initial step without, betting the farm on it, then when you fail, it's not a big deal. It's just an experiment. But if you make a big blunder that costs your company millions of dollars, yes, that's a big problem, and people aren't going to put up with that. So it's you kind of need to learn the strategy, and corporations need to learn this too, to learn to take on new things with the minimal first step with the least amount of risk.
What's your chapter title? Think Big, Act Small, I think it was?
Yes, yeah.
We'll go back to the phones. Thanks for bringing that up, Havik. We've got Michael with us in Greenfield. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love the show, and I'm going to have to get this book. I completely agree with what you guys are saying. I actually accidentally did this experiment last year. I'm in a band, and we came out with two albums. And the first one we took a couple years to make. And it was really good, it had a lot of thought to it, but didn't really have that well of a reception. And then our second one, we made a couple months to make, and just kind of going along the same things, but made it real quick, and it was way better. I mean, I completely agree with it, what you're saying.
All right. Well, Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that. It makes me think, too, with modern technology, say music recording, Ryan, instead of it being a long, elaborate process to burn vinyl albums, a band can pop a song all night the day they record it in practice, maybe get some feedback. Hey, that song was terrible. Here's what we need to change. They can fail often and keep refining their music in a way that wouldn't have been possible back in the old days.
Absolutely. That's a great example. Today, the technology and the tools that we have to create media and then just immediately post it and get feedback create opportunities to, as you're saying, fail, right away. Or just get, it's not necessarily failure. It's just getting your stuff out there and getting immediate feedback. And because you can do it that day, it means it encourages you to not spend, 5-6 months overworking something when you could just make something that day, get some feedback, and then improve it the next day.
One of the obstacles to this mindset that you talk about, this willingness to embrace failure, is an idea that a lot of us have a not-yet view of life. We're going to do this awesome thing someday, when the stars are right, when we're financially secure, when the economy's better, et cetera. How do we shake ourselves out of that?
Well, it's funny. That's kind of the main thing I do as a career counselor is try to change people's perspectives. It's hard to know exactly where it comes from, but as adults, we get very good at talking ourselves out of taking action. There's always some reason why, you know, we're not prepared enough, the time's not right, we need to focus on something else, or maybe we feel too stressed right now. It's so easy to come up with excuses not to do things, and you can flip that. There's always something you can do this week that will be something new. It's something you want to explore. It's something you're curious about. And it's really important to change that mindset from always talking yourself out of living the life you deserve to just being willing to find, well, what's that little step? It doesn't matter how small it is, but what's something I can do that'll get me out there to try something new?
Go back to our callers now. We've got Mark with us in Kenosha. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, years ago in the newspaper business, when we first started using desktop publishing techniques, somebody said to me, faster computer and it really must allow you to get your work done sooner, as though the objective was meeting the deadline. And I said, you know, and this was the early 90s, late 80s. I said, no. I said, what it allows me to do is to try more possibilities in the same amount of time and improve what I'm doing. And what I learned from that experience, I have applied pretty much to my entire life. I will come home at night and people say, what are you going to do? And I'm going to say, well, I'm going to do some wiring in the basement, or I'm going to throw a diesel engine in my pickup truck. And they say, you know how to do that? And I said, no, but how hard could it be?
Not yet.
You know?
All right, yeah. Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that. And that story about desktop publishing, I have the same story, but going from digital audio to, or from audio tape to digital editing. It was never faster. You just did it 8 different ways where you used to do it in one way. What do you think of Mark's story, Ryan?
I really like that example. I mean, the idea of using technology to try more things in the same amount of time, that's a really nice way to think about things. And that is, you know, that is an opportunity in so many fields. We have, you know, that's something that's possible in many more fields these days that wasn't available in the past.
In our last couple minutes, I think there are probably people out there saying, okay, this sounds nice. I don't know where to start. I don't even know what I want to do and fail at. Can you give us a few guidelines to get started? And let's use the words this week or maybe this weekend.
Sure. Well, one thing you can do is you can find, you know, most of us have this list of things like the things we want to do someday or try someday. I want to try yoga or hang gliding, or I want to learn Arabic, or, you know, travel to someplace. Well, one thing is to take this to-do list that's usually, you know, one day, a year, 2, 5 years, and make it a kind of this week list. Take those things and find something, you know, just pick one of those and find something, a little step you can do this week. So, you know, go to a, you know, sign up for a class, or go to a language class, or just, I guess it depends on what you're doing, but find some specific step. I mean, that's one way you can do it. Some other things I suggested before were to be a beginner, be willing to go out there and make mistakes, and also learn to unplan things. So instead of when there's something you're curious about trying, instead of making a big, huge production out of it and thinking about it long term and how you need to commit to it, just try to find the smallest step you can immediately take. And usually, there's something you can always something you can do in the next week or two, and that's all you need to worry about. You don't have to worry about the next month or year or 5 years. Just find the thing that you can do right away.
Ryan, what are you failing at lately, or what are you preparing to fail at in the near future?
Well, let's see. I'm starting a new business, which I think I guess that will be an opportunity to fail. Gosh, it seems like I'm so good at I'm always failing at things. I actually enjoy it. What are some other things? It's funny. You're kind of
caught you off guard there.
Yeah, you caught me. You caught me off guard. I mean, it's such a kind of main focus for me. I don't always think about it. It's just like, well, what am I exploring? What am I trying? You know, one thing I'm going to try as an adult just coming up is downhill skiing.
Oh,
which
there's
I'm
a biggie.
Looking forward to, like, you know, just going and taking my daughter with me, and we've already, you know, talked about how we're going to fall and, you know, just make fools of ourselves and have a great time doing it.
That's what I did last year with my daughters. It was very embarrassing, but it was a lot of fun. Ryan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me.
That was Ryan Babineau. He's a career counselor and co-author of the book Fail Fast, Fail Often, How Losing Can Help You Win.
Coming up next, we'll find out how many people in Wisconsin have signed up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act and why there's been concern about the age of the people signing up. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about enrollment in the new healthcare exchanges here in Wisconsin.
This week, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services released state-by-state data on Obamacare enrollment, and Wisconsin tied for the state with the most elderly adults enrolled in the healthcare exchanges.
Here to break down the data for us is Guy Bolton, a reporter who covers the business of healthcare and health policy for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Guy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So it sounds like the numbers enrolling in the Affordable Care Act, that has gone up. Tell us the change we've seen.
There was a sharp increase in enrollment in December, as you would expect, since the marketplaces or exchanges were essentially inoperable in October and much of November. They had so far a total of 40,752 people through, I believe, December 28th have signed up for plans on the marketplaces.
Does that mean Wisconsin is on its way to meeting its goal for enrollment?
That I don't know. We've lost essentially 2 months. December, you saw a surge or jump in enrollment. But the next 3 months is anybody's guess.
Go ahead.
No, there's going to be a lot of work for people who are helping people sign up for coverage between now and March 31st, the deadline.
Do you know what we can attribute the jump in people signing up to? Do you think it's just that the website is working better? Is it a simple matter of time?
My guess would be that it's the website was working. I mean, the launch of the Affordable Care Act websites was marketplaces was a disaster. There's just no getting around that. And supporters would acknowledge that, as would opponents.
So one of the biggest headlines to come out of these numbers is that Wisconsin tied with West Virginia as the state with the highest number of older adults enrolled in exchanges. What do you make of that news?
What I have been told, and we will have a story this weekend on this, is the figures were the enrollment among people who were young and presumably healthy were certainly lower than expected, but nothing that was shocking. In Wisconsin, the real test will be what happens in the next few months. What people say is that people who are younger are more likely to come in towards the March 31st deadline. And the folks that I've interviewed have said that, it's really just too early to gauge what this means or could mean.
So more older adults enrolled right now, fewer younger people. What is the age range for older adults that we're talking about?
There was about 45% of the people who have enrolled in plans sold on the marketplaces were between the ages of 55 and 64 in Wisconsin. People who are 26 to 34, it was 12%. For people who were 18 to 25, it was 7%. A brief that Kaiser Family Foundation put out estimated that about 40% of the population would be in the, say, 18 to 35 age group, and that ideally, you know, that's the proportion of people you would want in the so-called risk pools for these health plans.
So as you said yourself, you think that younger people may likely come in closer to that March 31st deadline. In the meantime, though, are there concerns that because there are so many more older people enrolled in the Affordable Care Act that it's going to drive the prices up?
You know, certainly there are concerns. I mean, and certainly opponents have jumped on this and warned of what is known as a death spiral in the insurance industry. The experience in Massachusetts was younger people came in later. How many young people will come in the first year is anybody's guess. But the conventional wisdom held that in the first year of the Affordable Care Act, there would be less younger people coming into the marketplaces. The you know, what it means going forward is kind of a different story. You know, there is general agreement, though, that you do need young and healthy people to offset the costs of people who are older and more likely to be sicker. That's the way insurance works.
Now, there are some Obamacare advocates who are saying that this is news that should alert state leaders that they need to put more effort into reaching out to young people, marketing to young people, raising awareness about the Affordable Care Act. Do you think that's going to happen?
Yes, I don't know. But, you know, they certainly don't have a lot of time.
So what do you think will happen if those numbers don't roll in?
The people I've interviewed for the story that we'll have this weekend have said it is just too early to tell. I mean, there are people certainly who are predicting that this will lead to sharp increases in 2015 and future years. But the folks I have spoken to have said that, you know, it is just too early to tell. And there are a variety of factors that go into rates. Also, what is hard to gauge is actuaries tend to be conservative, and it is reasonable to assume that to some degree they built into the rates the widespread expectation that fewer young people would come into these plans in the first year.
So that may be built in.
Could be built in, and there are other factors. In 2015, the exchanges, next year, the exchanges will be, presumably, the exchanges will be working and have a better design. The penalty for not having coverage increases next year and in 2016. This year, it is just 1% of your income or a minimum of $95. By 2016, it is 2.5% of your income. And, you know, when it gets up to 2.5%, you know, for people may feel like, well, I'm not, instead of paying the penalty and getting nothing, I'll get health insurance.
And do you think there is a reason that you could point to right now that young people haven't signed out? Is it simple procrastination, or is it more that 1% isn't enough, like you were just talking about?
That would just be conjecture on my part. I mean, certainly, you know, with all the stories about the exchange not working, you would think, why mess with this? There have been, you know, various surveys done, and they conflict, but there seems, you know, some surveys have suggested that there young people do have a value for health insurance, and that, you know, they will eventually come in into the marketplace and buy health plans.
Well, Guy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Guy Bolton, a reporter who covers the business of healthcare and health policy for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, we began our new series covering the inner workings of the United States Congress, one of the least liked in American history, according to recent polls.
Last Wednesday, we talked about the prospects for extending the federal unemployment benefits that expired in December. We'll get an update on where those stand today. And also this week, Congress appears to have agreed on an appropriations bill that would keep the government open through September.
If the bill passes, it would be the first of its kind since 2011. We're joined now by USA Today Congress and Politics editor Paul Singer. He blogs at How Government Works and tweets from @SingerNews. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. How are you doing?
Great. Well, before we get to that appropriations bill, Democratic Representative Jim Moran from Virginia announced today he's not going to seek re-election. He's been in Congress a long time. He's 68. Is there anything more to this than a congressman deciding, hey, time to pack it in?
Not in the individual context, no. I think he's just a congressman packing it in. But what's interesting, if you look at the trend over the past few weeks, there's been a half dozen members in the same sort of tranche as Moran. That is, people who are more or less centrist, have been in Congress a while, and are leaving and retiring now because they just don't want to do it anymore. I sort of am seeing this as like the hollowing out of the middle of the Congress. Many of these folks, you know, Moran's district is a Democratic district, and it'll stay a Democratic district, but many of these folks are in sort of swing districts. If they were conservative Democrats, those seats are going to go to Republicans. If they were moderate Republicans, those seats are probably going to go to Democrats. But you'll just see, it's interesting to see that we've now got about a half dozen or so retirements of people who are considered long-serving, respected moderates.
Well, and that, between that and primary challenges within parties targeting relative moderates, are there going to be any moderates left, at least worthy of the term moderate, in the next few years?
I'm not sure there's much money in it. Honestly, you know, being a moderate in the U.S. Congress is kind of a lonely place to hang out. We've watched the demise of several fairly significant caucuses that were built on these sort of centrist principles. They've just sort of all drained out.
Now, you know, maybe if that keeps happening, it's going to be hard for Congress to get anything done. I know that's crazy science fiction talk, but yeah. Is it going to make it even harder to find compromise?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot of upside to these guys to compromising on a lot of these issues. And so what you end up seeing is they don't pass a lot of bills. And they frequently don't work together on stuff. Now, there obviously are issues where you do see compromise. Not to make too graphic a segue, but we're moving on right now. There is an appropriations bill moving on the House floor, and it's going to pass with large bipartisan support because the alternative is so catastrophically bad that nobody wants to vote against it.
But the alternative has been catastrophically bad before, and people still voted against it. Why is it different now?
Because they were once bitten, twice shy. I mean, at this point, the Republicans were really opposed to the size of the spending bills and attempted to basically demand cuts in exchange for raising the debt ceiling back in the fall, and we got the government shutdown, and that did not work out well for them. The party really took a hit. And I think it was very, very clear from all the leadership on the Republican side they did not want that to happen again. So over Christmas, when it was announced that we've come to an agreement, bipartisan agreement, on sort of a budget deal for 2 years that just sets the levels of overall spending, at that point it was clear that the fight was going to be over. And so what they're now doing is passing a bill that nobody's read. I mean, this thing is 1,500 pages long. It was introduced 3 days ago. It's being passed now. We'll find out what's in it in a couple of weeks.
Ordinarily, when this kind of bill comes along, I would expect to see another 1,500 pages of amendments. Are we seeing any amendment process on this?
No.
None at all?
That's how they get the thing passed. That's the beauty of this thing, Rob, is if nobody reads it and no one's allowed to amend it, how can you vote no? And that's how they're handling this. They're just going to march it through. In fact, you know, the other thing to keep in mind, none of this is traditional, right? I mean, normally you would have a bill that funds the EPA and the Veterans Administration. You'd have a bill that funds the Justice Department. And there's 12 different appropriations bills, and they go through the committees and everyone. They spent 6 months doing this. This thing, they took all those bills, mashed them into one giant bill, wrote it over the past couple of months with only three people involved, And nobody's read it. And now they're passing it in 3 days.
And I've seen some commentary that, hey, in those 1,500 pages, there are a lot of little things targeting specific states, districts, and regions, what we used to call maybe pork or that kind of thing. Is that part of why some people are ready to vote for this thing without making too big a muss about it?
Yeah, I suspect. Yeah, I mean, there are what we call sweeteners. You call them pork. We call them sweeteners.
Sweet pork and a barbecue sauce.
Part of the way they do these things is they sit down and decide what can we put in this bill that's going to make it palatable to people to vote for, and everyone has to be able to go back to their district and say, hey, we did something useful. And you know, there's winners and losers. I mean, the Pentagon gets a lot of money in here, you know, Joe Biden loses because they're capping his salary and they're cutting a high speed rail, which he was a big fan of. So, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of provisions in here for everybody to find something they will like. That's how you get people to say, well, okay, I'll close my eyes, hold my nose, and vote for it.
Speaking of closed eyes, light bulbs were one of the things I saw in this. The enforcement of the ban on the old-fashioned light bulbs.
I hate this story.
Why?
Because it's not exactly what it says it is. I mean,
okay.
There are new energy efficiency rules that the Energy Department has put into effect, by the way, which were required by law some years ago. And it's energy efficiency for a whole bunch of stuff, including light bulbs. Well, the light bulb ones, the way to meet the new standards is with a compact fluorescent bulb. It's not the only way to meet the standards. I mean, in theory, you could invent an incandescent bulb that would meet the standard, but no one's really thought they're going to. And the industry's not going that way anyway. The industry is building these things, these, you know, LED bulbs and other sort of high-tech bulbs anyhow. So what this does is removes enforcement of the rules. That is, removes funding for the enforcement of the rules. Okay, well, and keep in mind, we haven't banned, there's no ban on incandescent bulbs anyway, and they're also, the efficiency rules exempt stuff like appliance bulbs, your refrigerator bulb, things like that. So it's much more subtle than the way it is described. The way it is described is the army is going to come march over to your house and unscrew all your light bulbs and leave you in the dark. And it's just not true. But, you know, it's hard to, you know. Ah, the details. The people get tired of the details.
Well, here's another one that's been in the news a lot, and people are kind of cherry-picking details, it seems like. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates's memoir, Duty, came out. People have, depending on which side you're on, picked out criticisms of the Obama administration, praise of it, same with the Bush administration. What did he have to say about Congress, though?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is that he had nice and bad things to say about everybody except Congress. And Congress, he said, basically, these people are horrible. Yeah, I mean, there's a line in there, I don't have it in front of me, but it was something along the lines of, you know, sitting in front of Congress at a hearing, I wanted to get up out of my chair and throw up. You know, how could I be treated this way by these people who are stupid, self-serving, disinterested in the public good, preening, uninformed. I mean, he just like goes on and on and on. It is clear he viewed the U.S. Congress as just a pool of swine, and he didn't understand why he had to spend so much time dealing with these people who really didn't care about anything except scoring political points. It's a fairly remarkable blast.
Is that, do you think there's something to what he's saying, or is this just maybe any cabinet official who has to endure a congressional subcommittee hearing every couple of weeks or however often is going to feel a natural resentment there?
I think there's some of that. But I mean, I also think that obviously, you know, when we talk about this around the water cooler, that because the tone of Congress has changed so much and because there's so much less interest in legislating and more interest in scoring political points, I think you might see Gates's criticism as more a sign of the times and than it was, you know, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I suspect what somebody like that would have said, or maybe 20 years ago would have said, is, man, those guys are a nuisance, but they're sometimes doing good work. Now, this guy is saying, they're all stupid. I can't stand them.
Wow. Well, here's some more news about Congress before we let you go. OpenSecrets.org published a study over the last week saying that for the first time in its history, the majority of Congress are millionaires. Money in politics isn't a new issue. Is this a surprising new bit of news?
No. And it's not a surprising bit of news. In fact, I'll tell you, it also understates the case. Those estimates are based on the financial disclosure forms that members of Congress file, which allow them to leave out vast amounts of assets, leave out or understate vast amounts of assets. So my suspicion is that if you had true assets reported in these things, you'd find that number closer to two-thirds to three-quarters of Congress are millionaires. If you include stuff like, well, they own a house, right? That adds up already. You know, the fact of the matter is that if you are not a wealthy person, it's going to be hard for you to take, 6 months off to run for Congress and ask people to donate money and go to all the events and shake hands. And both parties are trying to recruit rich people to run for Congress because it's easier to fund your campaign by yourself rather than asking people for money.
Right. That's a dream candidate. You can pay for your own campaign. We can put our money somewhere else.
Yeah, we call them self-funders. I mean, that's the whole point. You know, people still raise money because that's how you show support, right? You want to be able to show that people do support you. But, yeah, having a lot of leisure time and a lot of money at your disposal makes it a lot easier to run for Congress, particularly in the modern era. So, no, I'm not surprised at all to see, you know, the lion's share of Congress. They're wealthy people. I mean, they just are wealthy people. They're the only people who can afford to keep two houses, right? You got to go back and forth between Washington and your district. It's just not, by and large, it is not a job for somebody who doesn't have money.
We'll leave it there. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Good talking to you, Rob.
That's Paul Singer. He's politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time.